This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get an update on RFID chip technology. Joining us is Liz McIntyre, co-author of the book Spy Chips. Also, we'll hear from John Ehrenberg, author of the book Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. He delivered a scathing indictment of right-wing ideology at this year's Left Forum in New York. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We will be bringing you updates here on Law and Disorder on the intrusiveness of RFID technology. RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification. Some are passive and can be read with scanners up to 3 feet or more. Others broadcast a specific signal. In the past, we've discussed how big corporations plan to embed the so-called spy chip into clothes, credit cards, shoes, and human flesh, all in the name of convenience, safety, and commerce. The breach of civil liberties is staggering. Now, however, the move to inject and track human beings with RFID chips is becoming a reality. It sounds like a scene from Steven Spielberg's futuristic film Minority Report, but a plan is underway right now to inject chips into 200 elderly Alzheimer's patients in Florida. The producers of the chip say that implantation should always be voluntary, but many question the ethics of conducting research on the medically impaired. Joining us today is Liz McIntyre, co-author of the book Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and the Government Plan to Track Your Every Move. She's an expert on this new technology that has literally hundreds of patent applications pending approval for a wide range of uses. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Liz.
Heidi, hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Before we discuss specifics of the Alzheimer implantation plan, could you remind our listeners what exactly are VeriChip implants?
Well, VeriChip implants are RFID devices. They're glass encapsulated, and they're for insertion into human flesh. They have a unique identification number, like any other RFID tag, that can be linked to virtually unlimited information in a database. And, of course, this chip can be read from a distance. In this case, the current models can be read from about a foot or so away.
How are the chips actually implanted, and then how are they commonly used?
The chips are implanted with a large cannula, which is a broad, hollow-tubed needle that actually slides this chip under the skin into the triceps area of the upper arm. And the way they're used, there are three purposes for the chip right now. One is to link to medical records. Theoretically, someone who can't speak for himself or herself, a doctor could scan the unique number on the chip, go into a database, and pull up information about a patient. The other use is as a security device, say to open a secure door. That was already demonstrated in Ohio when some employees were asked to get chipped to enter a secure room as part of their jobs. And third, it's as a payment device when linked to a credit card. There are some bar hoppers over in Barcelona, Spain at the Baja Beach Club who were chipped so they could bypass a waiting line and enter a VIP champagne lounge.
And also they wouldn't have to carry burdensome wallets or purses.
Right, and detract from their outfits.
Right. is it true that human beings aren't commonly implanted right now?
No, it's very rare. In fact, no one's been beating a path to the VeriChip door. The company's had a very, very difficult time attracting anyone crazy enough to get chipped. And we understand it's about 250 people now worldwide who have been chipped, many of them associated with the company in some way. In fact, the company often offers the chips free to encourage some participation.
So that VeriChip is the leading manufacturer of RFID chips?
Well, for humans, yes.
For humans.
Yes, and they're the RFID company for humans. They're very proud of that.
The chips that are implanted in merchandise, for example, could be used for inventory control in a store, ostensibly?
Correct. And VeriChip does make some chips for that purpose, although their main goal, of course, is to chip human flesh.
Mm-hmm.
But they are exactly the same. They work on the same principle as the chips that you might find on products in store shelves, as you mentioned, for inventory control. They're now starting to creep onto our store floors, though, into individual products we might buy every day.
Now, who came up with the plan to inject these chips into Alzheimer's patients?
That's a good question. I'm sure it originated at VeriChip headquarters. They've been anxious to find any opportunity to get into our flesh. The company, as you may know, recently had an IPO and an initial public offering of stock to raise millions of dollars to chip people. And they have a contract to buy millions of these chips over time, and they have to put them somewhere or they're going to be in serious trouble. The company's been losing millions and millions of dollars for years. They've never turned a profit. They're desperate, really, to try to get inroads any way they can.
Now, are they working at all with our government?
Well, actually, they do have quite a few large contracts with the federal government. Actually, their parent company, Applied Digital Solutions. There's been talk about working with the government in ways that we would find horrible, I think, many of us. They're talking about chipping the military instead of using dog tags, for example. There's been even talk at high levels about chipping immigrants to this country before they get here to prove basically who they are and their right to be here.
Now, so those would not be voluntary injections, implantations?
Well, that's interesting. They still call it voluntary, at least the VeriChip people do. But, of course, you and I both know that there's a fine line between what is strictly optional and what is mandatory.
Right.
If you have a great incentive to get chipped, someone may not be holding a gun to your head, but you might have to roll up your sleeve or, say, not be able to participate in modern society.
Right, if you wanted to get into the country. Well, Liz, the natural next question is, could this be paving the road for a universal identification program in this country?
Well, we are already paving that road. As you know, the Real ID Act passed in 2005. This gives the Department of Homeland Security to set federal driver's license standards. Right now, states have their own standards. They issue their own licenses. But this new plan is going to have standard information that every driver's license would have, requirements for proving who you are, and it would create a vast national database that could be accessed by state governments and the federal government. Now, that's just a first step. Of course, once you have this information in the database and you can link it to people, obviously the next step could be that everyone has a chip.
Mm.
Perhaps in a driver's license.
The new passports have them.
And of course, eventually, if we allow it, these things could work their way into our skin.
Yes, I could see when a newborn child enters the world, chipping them at the hospital.
I don't think you're going to see that immediately, but down the road, they have this vision, and we are indoctrinating our youngest members of society to accept this type of technology. You're seeing RFID technology creeping into every everyday items, including toys, for example. There are several toys out there, dolls with RFID in them that can identify foods they're eating, the people they're around, the clothes they're wearing. Mm. We see cooking sets. A little tyke puts out a cooking kitchen that can talk to you. And, of course, this mirrors plans in society to have RFID ubiquitous in the things we buy, wear, and carry, reader devices in public places, and also in our homes, in our kitchens, in our stoves, so that information is shared in vast databases in public places as well as in our private spaces.
Liz, getting back to the Alzheimer plan, what are the alleged benefits of implanting these chips in the elderly?
Well, yeah, and they are alleged, Heidi. I'm glad you used that word. The Verichip Corporation is selling this, actually I believe donating in this case, but selling the idea as a way for people who can't speak for themselves to have medical information readily available if they should find themselves in an emergency room. Of course, there are perhaps other applications like access to doorways and so on, but right now they're focusing on this medical information aspect. Now, well, what's interesting is the Verichip Corporation does not guarantee that this chip is merchantable or fit for its purpose. There's actually a release form that patients have to sign stating they understand that. Verichip literature says the database with this patient information may not be available in an emergency, and they indicate in their SEC registration statement, a statement they had to file before issuing stock this spring, that their databases, in fact, have been down at times, and they worry about a lawsuit should, say, someone die because their information isn't available. The caution here is don't throw away your Medic Alert bracelet and count on your Verichip to give out information. Here's another great one. The Verichip Corporation says this chip may not be readable in places with ambient radio waves, and they name one place an ambulance. Unbelievable. Your solution, take the patient out of the ambulance or turn off all radio equipment. Both pretty untenable. Oh, and the other thing, MRI. Verichip says this is safe for MRI purposes and so on. However, in the literature they supplied it to doctors in the kits they provide, says a patient should not go into an MRI unless he can communicate with the MRI operator. Now, if you're putting these in Alzheimer's patients, I think that probably precludes having any kind of an MRI after this point.
Well, this sounds like a vast experimentation plan.
Well, it is. In fact, we see this as using the elderly as guinea pigs, and we don't think it's fair. We should be protecting the most vulnerable members of our society and not using them for highly controversial technology.
Well, I read that you've compared large-scale implantation literally to assembly lines that render the elderly scannable like barcoded packages of meat. But not an effective scan, as you've pointed out. The information may not be valid or may not even be there.
Absolutely. And, you know, we do have a growing elderly population. We do have a crisis on the horizon. But I don't believe that the thing to do here as a society is to relegate people to machines and simply put them off, cast them off to the side and let some controversial, perhaps faulty technology babysit.
It would be one thing if the chips were used to locate an elderly person who got lost somewhere.
That's really not, at this point, something that chip can do, Heidi. A lot of people have a mistaken impression that this thing, you know, can be tracked from a satellite. The chip is about the size of a dime in your skin. It does not have a GPS transceiver in there. It can be read from about a foot, maybe 2 feet away. Now, of course, if there are reader devices in the environment, say in hallways of nursing homes, those readers could be connected to GPS devices that could transmit to satellites and pinpoint someone on the planet. But when someone's lost, they're not lost typically in the nursing home or the hospital.
Right.
They're far away from any kind of reader devices or technology that could really be useful.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Liz McIntyre, co-author of the book Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and the Government Plan to Track Your Every Move. She's an expert on this new technology that has literally hundreds of patent applications pending approval for a wide range of uses. Well, Liz, if this plan is implemented, which we hope it won't be, what do you see as the next step?
Of course, the Verichip is looking for inroads anywhere they can find them. And they've been doing anything. They've been circling like vultures, basically. They've volunteered their technology to chip deceased victims of storms like Hurricane Katrina.
Wait, I'm sorry, explain that?
Actually, Hurricane Katrina, of course, a huge disaster, and many people lost their lives. And in fact, in some cases, the storm waters washed up graves and bodies from graveyards. And so the Verichip people took their chip mobile They call it a Hippo-Mobile, and drove it out to the disaster area and said, we've got this great technology. We'd like to donate our technology and chip the deceased and chip body parts. The medical examiners took them up on it.
No.
They did, yes. Yes, and of course, this was out without the knowledge or consent.
Of the families?
Of the families, yes. And that's hugely problematic.
But what's the purpose of chipping them after they're deceased?
To identify and locate them. But of course, we have traditional methods that would do just as well, and many people would find that a desecration. And
of course.
They would be horrified if they thought that that would happen to them and wouldn't want that to happen. But they had no... They couldn't speak for themselves, and they go, of course, here, again, we're chipping, you know, Alzheimer's patients who can't say no. So what they're doing is they're going after the most vulnerable, the people who can't say no, because the people who can say no are running as fast as they can away from this product.
Liz, when you last talked with us, you shared some examples of pending patent applications. One in specific that comes to mind was the chip that could emit a shock-like cattle prod a sensation to the individual who was chipped. Are any of those patents reaching fruition? Do you know?
I haven't checked on this one lately. I'll have to go back and look at it. It's called A Method and Apparatus for Locating and Tracking Persons by a company called Persephone out of California. And they talk about a chip similar to the Vera chip, except it would be implanted deep within the body, in natural pockets of internal organs, like in the female uterus, for example, or deep in the head. The idea is that people wouldn't be able to dig them out. Like the Vera chip is too close to the surface, they lament, and could possibly be removed because it would be deep within the body and potentially, you know, for tracking purposes, they want to have a GPS device in there. They have other accessories, as you mentioned, one, the cattle prod-like shock that could be given if someone gets out of line. For example, if someone walks too close to a cockpit in an airplane, could possibly be shocked.
Interesting.
Yeah. Of course, there's a microphone accessory this patent application talks about, so that conversations can be broadcast remotely.
Wait, are you saying that basically someone could be listening in from remote through the chip?
Based on my reading of this patent application, yes.
Liz,
yes.
Verichip's in financial trouble. How are they continuing to operate if they don't have support system?
Well, they have lots of support, unfortunately. IBM is a huge investor in this company, and they have raised quite a bit of money, even though less than they had hoped for, with their recent IPO.
They're not reaching bankruptcy at this point.
Unfortunately, they're still a viable organization as far as we can tell. And, of course, you know, IBM doesn't want to lose its shirt, and there are lots of big money interests involved. So we think that they'll try to keep them afloat and just look for opportunities to spread their product. And we think some of the higher profile tests they're running now, like, for example, with Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey. And
what are they doing there?
Well, with Blue Cross Blue Shield, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, the oldest and largest New Jersey insurer, is working with Hackensack University Medical Center and Verichip Corporation to build a business case for chipping humans. Here, a medical business case to link these chips to medical records.
In New Jersey only?
New Jersey, right now, right. So what they're doing is, even though they're losing millions and millions of dollars, and to most of us it seems like an absolutely crazy idea, they are just looking for any opportunity to turn the tide.
Right. Now, you had mentioned also, before we started our interview, about a MediaCart chip plan?
Oh, this is very interesting. Channel 2 Israel, which is the largest television station in Israel, sent one of its anchors over and a whole crew to film a four-part documentary series on privacy. They're comparing privacy in Israel to privacy in the United States, and they contacted me to film with them. And, of course, I helped them find some locations for filming. And one of the locations was a place called MediaCart, located in Plano, Texas. And we went in there to see their high-tech shopping cart system. Now, what this is like a normal shopping cart, but underneath the carriage is a large plastic box of sorts that has an RFID reader in it. And the plan is to roll this out in increments, and it eventually becomes more and more invasive as time goes on. Initially, they're going to have these RFID tags at different locations on the shelf so they can track as carts go through the store what the path of those carts is, and hopefully at the checkout when someone turns in a loyalty card or pays with some other identifiable form of payment, they can figure out how people are shopping and compare that to how much money they spend, that kind of thing. So they can, you know, improve what they do and get more of our money by learning more about
consumer
it.
Research.
Consumer research, absolutely. And the plan is eventually, though, to get even more invasive, not only have these tags every couple of feet on the shelves, but then eventually to have them in front of every product on a shelf, and then eventually on the products themselves. And, of course, the plan is to have every product on planet Earth with an RFID tag on it.
Right.
So they will get more and more detailed information about people as they shop. And because people stop and look and pick up different things, eventually they will be able to tell if someone is even comparison shopping. I mean, what do you put in your cart with other types of items? This is exactly the kind of thing we were talking about in our book, Spy Chips.
I'm glad you mentioned your book. How's it doing, and what's the full title?
Well, we have several out, of course. The first is Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. A recent Penguin Plume paperback edition that's updated called Spy Chips with a slightly different subtitle. It's out in Spanish also. And we understand they're talking about perhaps putting that out in Brazil. And, of course, that would be in Portuguese.
What can listeners do if they're intrigued by this and spurred to action?
Our website at spychips.com, that's spychips with an S. We have lots of information there about RFID, pictures of the technology, and of course a link for anyone interested in learning more about our book. What do people do? Well, in our book we talk about steps people can actually take to stop this freight train of a technology that's, you know, going to be the worst thing to happen to privacy probably in the last 25, 30 years. And steps like don't buy things from these retailers and manufacturers who are pushing this agenda, places like Walmart, companies like Procter & Gamble, companies like Unilever, Kraft, all the major companies, international, global corporations, they all want this technology. They want to learn all about us. They want to know about our shopping habits. And, of course, the goal is to know more about us than even our own moms have a right to know so they can sell us more things.
Liz, as always, it's really a pleasure to have you on. Our listeners really enjoy your segments and the information that you share with us. Keep up the good work and let us know when the next chilling development occurs.
Absolutely, we'll do.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Hello, everybody. I want to tell you about a little dream I had this morning. I had a dream that I went down this beautiful corridor and there was a cot. And there was someone sleeping in the cot. And I went, and there sleeping under a beautiful piece of white muslin was Gandhi. And I stood over him and watched him sleep. And next to him there was a water glass, and it was empty. So I put some distilled water in it and watched him sleep for a while. And then I woke up. And what I took that as, I took it as a good sign. I took it to remember one important thing, the most important thing, that the people can accomplish anything. But how do the people accomplish it? Through their numbers. Gandhi proved that the people could accomplish anything through their numbers. Now, we have seen in the media, which teaches us nothing, that 96% are behind the president's foreign policy. I guess we're the 4% that isn't. Let's make that 4% grow and grow and grow. People, we must unite. These little gatherings are the beginning. We must unite, and we must get strong. We must be clean. And if you're worried about all of the things that they're trying to make you scared about, whether it's germs or anything, you want to do something for yourself, take care of yourself. Build your immune system. Be strong. Don't be afraid. And don't be led by the media. We, the people, are supposed to dictate foreign policy. Right now, our government is keeping us out of foreign policy. That is a direct infringement of our rights. Don't just sit around and let them think for us. Be strong. Be strong. Be aware. Wake up. We have the power. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, will have an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry. Come on.
Hold on.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled there together, when none to laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. 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 the power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.
We go now to listen to a speech by political scientist John Ehrenberg. He spoke at the Left Forum this year on a panel entitled Bush and Company's War on Civil Liberties and What It Means for Our Future. John Ehrenberg is the author of the recent book, Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. This is his third book where he critically analyzes the rise of an ideologically coherent right. He dissects their themes of military weakness, moral decay, racial anxiety, and hostility to social welfare to reveal their central organizing objective of protecting wealth and assaulting equality. Let's have a listen.
Okay, I want to do what academics do, and that is to step back a little bit and try to talk about context and a bit of history so we can understand who these people are and what the project is and what they're about. And when you look at what's happened to the contemporary right over the past 25 years, there's something curious about it that doesn't really, on the face of it, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This is a political project and a political campaign that's been in power for the better part of a quarter of a century. And that's a long time. That's a whole generation. It's gone through a whole series of changes and developments. And one of the things that's happened over the past 25 years, which is really contrary to a lot of historical experience and contrary to a lot of social science theory, is that this right-wing movement has gotten steadily more and more radical over time, not less so. Social scientists expect that as movements develop, they have a tendency to become less radical over time. They tend to get founded by ideologues. They tend to get organized by crusaders. They're very excited in the beginning. They have grand projects and big schemes. And over time, so goes a lot of social movement theory, they become co-opted. They get some accomplishments under their belts. They make deals with politicians. They develop a certain stake in the existing order. And generally speaking, the radical hard edges of the movements tend to drop off, and they tend to be accommodated. And that hasn't happened here. What's happened with the right over the past 25 years is its opposite. It's gotten more radical and not less. It's gotten more ideological and not less. It's gotten more excited and not less. And it's happened from the grassroots to the top of the movement. There's a tendency when we look at the kinds of things Michael's talking about to focus exclusively on the president and his chief officers. But what we're witnessing with regard to the right in general is that from the grassroots all the way through, you're seeing a much more organized, a much more excited, a much more militant, and a much more aggressive right wing. And what I mean by that is that we have to look not only at the Bush administration, which is arguably the most radically right-wing administration, certainly in the country's recent history, but you have to look also at the Congress. The congressional Republicans, beginning certainly from 1994 on, and that's 13 years now, when you look at people like Senator Thune from South Dakota and some of these guys from the Southwest, you're dealing with a radically right-wing Republican Party from which, as we all know from the last elections, whatever remnants of East Coast Republican moderation have been long expelled, and at the grassroots as well. This is a very, very, very radical movement. So one of the questions is why? You know, what's been going on to produce this tendency, and how does it how does it eventuate in the so-called theory of the unitary precedent and the attack on civil liberties? I'm going to try to spend just a few minutes with you trying to set some of the problems in their context. In some senses, this whole intensification of this movement's radical project really took a leap forward after 9/11. And we all know that that's what happens in times of terrorism, and it's what happens in times of crisis and war, is that already existing tendencies tend to get exaggerated and tend to get intensified. And that's certainly what's been happening here. So there are two ways to look at this thing. On the one hand, you can look at what happened after 9/11. And it does seem as though a lot of the people around the president, a lot of the people in Congress, and a lot of people at the grassroots were genuinely freaked out and genuinely super worried about what had developed after 9/11 and sought ways in which to cope with a new environment of threat and of danger. On the other hand, these tendencies always had been there in the radical right. And they were intensified and used by people for whom 9/11 was a present, and for whom Osama bin Laden turns out to be their great ally. So when you look at the various pieces of the contemporary right, there are authoritarian tendencies in almost all of them. And the contemporary right is a coalition, like most political movements, and it's a coalition of elements who, in some senses, disagree with each other and are in conflict with each other and historically have been at war with each other, and on the other hand, come together around certain shared projects. There are lots of elements of this coalition. There are signs now that it's beginning to fray a little bit, but for our purposes, for the purposes of trying to figure out the war on civil liberties, there are a couple of elements of these coalitions that are particularly important. One of them are the moral authoritarians, originating in the South, people who have long been calling for a strong Christian state to regulate people's private behavior, legislate morality, and get the country back to God. And when you go back to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all these guys coming out of the South, these people were able to blend religious revivalism and excitement on the one hand with old-fashioned political authoritarianism on the other. So that's one piece of it. These people are mostly worried about domestic affairs, and they mostly arose as a reaction to what they perceived as the catastrophic breakdown of authority during the 60s, and particularly as it manifested itself in the women's movement and in racial matters. So as they called for a restoration of male authority, and as they called for a restoration of racial peace, they were not afraid to call upon the state as their chief ally in this. And when you read people like Falwell, and as unpleasant as it is, it makes sense to do it, they're calling for a Christian state, and they're calling for a Christian government. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it, for our purposes, tends to focus on foreign policy, and these are the neoconservatives. And in some respects, the neocons and the Christian warriors of the South share certain presumptions, but they also disagree about lots. Many of the neocons are Eastern, cosmopolitan, Jewish intellectuals. Many of them, as they themselves point out, were defenders of the New Deal. They see themselves as social reformers. They were friendly to FDR. They didn't much like Lyndon Johnson and the war on poverty. But in foreign affairs, these are authoritarian statists. Their major concern was with the restoration of American authority in international sphere and, of course, with the restoration of presidential authority when it comes to conducting foreign policy. We'll come back to that in a second. When it comes to certain issues, the Southern-based moral authoritarians, on the one hand, and the neocons in matters of foreign policy, on the other, don't agree about a whole lot. The neocons have no use for the moralizing, Christianizing project of the American South. And the people in the South are suspicious of the neocons' secularism and their tendency at times to support social reform. So there are, even as there are wide areas of agreement around presidential authority and the restoration of the state, there are serious disagreements. And you can see now, as this movement begins to fray apart, you begin to see some of the consequences of these disagreements. It makes sense to start in trying to figure out what is the connection between this excitable, politicized, contradictory coalition that comprises the contemporary right and the assault on civil liberties, it begins to make sense to start at the center with Dick Cheney. And Cheney is only, there's a tendency to paint Cheney as the Darth Vader of this whole thing, and John Stewart always paints Cheney as the guy who walks into a room and sucks all the air out of the room, and while all that's true, and Stewart is really wonderful on Cheney. But it's not just Cheney. Cheney, this thing really does start with Bush. Cheney is the guy who's articulated it and whose record for the last 30 years in and out of Washington has been most clear. Cheney, ever since the Ford administration, Cheney has had two projects. And his projects mirror what I've been saying and also kind of sum up the attitude of the contemporary right to the state. Cheney's analysis is that the great debilitating set of constraints that emerged out of the 60s, out of the war in Vietnam, needed to be overturned in the interests of American security on the one hand and American prosperity at home on the other. Those two constraints historically have been called the so-called Watergate syndrome, and the second was the so-called Vietnam syndrome. And in Cheney's mind, Cheney has a very articulated, I mean, Cheney is a reflexive authoritarian, but he does have a position. And the position is that coming out of the Watergate scandals, you saw a crippling of the power of the presidency, a weakening of the tendency of power in the United States to flow toward Washington, and that it was important for a vigorous, muscular presidency to be able to overcome the legacy of the restrictions on presidential power that came out of Watergate.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to John Ehrenberg, speaking at the Left Forum this year on a panel entitled Bush and Company's War on Civil Liberties and What It Means for Our Future. The panel was chaired by our own Michael Smith.
The second, and from Cheney's point of view, the most important restrictions revolve around what the historians and what the people in these movements call the so-called Vietnam Syndrome, which were a series of restrictions, both institutional and legal, that were put on the president's power to conduct foreign policy that came out of the war in Vietnam. On both of these issues, Cheney has long been agitating in and around government that the legacy of both the Vietnam Syndrome and the Watergate Syndrome had to be undone. And the reason that Cheney constructed this parallel office around his office of vice president was precisely to do this. And whether it's Scooter Libby or Douglas Feith, but the real bad guy in the whole story is David Addington, about whom people don't know a whole lot. Addington is a longtime associate of Dick Cheney's. He has replaced Scooter Libby as Cheney's chief of staff. Addington, for the last 30 years, has had one project and one project only as he's worked with Cheney. Every single initiative coming out of Congress, every single law that's been proposed by the president is vetted by Cheney's office and in particular by Addington. And the one question that's on the table always is, what is this going to do to the authority and the power of the president? Cheney is, of all the people around Bush, the one who is most closely associated with this power to revive the power of the executive. Now, how does that dovetail with a larger political project? After all presidents want to consolidate their power. And every president, for example, since the Vietnam War, has resisted the War Powers Act. It's not just Bush that resists it. Clinton resisted it as well. So presidents, almost regardless of their ideological position and their political party, do tend to want to preserve and extend their own power. But when it comes to these guys and the contemporary political project of this very ideological, very excited, and now very radical right, we have to associate these kinds of bureaucratic and legal positions with their larger political project. And that is that, and I think this is really what accounts for this odd radicalization of the contemporary right. The right arose out of the what they saw as the chaos and the decay and the decline of the 1960s, with two projects in mind. The central project was to utterly destroy American liberalism. Their target was never the left. The target of the right has always been the legacy of American liberalism coming out of the New Deal. With regard to the current administration, the most extreme form of this has been an attempted attack on the most significant piece of social legislation coming out of the New Deal, which was Social Security. The reason that the attack on Social Security and the attempt to privatize it was so important is that Social Security has always represented to the contemporary right everything about liberalism and social reform that they hated. And that is the statement that the Social Security law made and that the defense of Social Security was always organized around, which is that we live in a society in which people have mutual responsibilities to each other. And Social Security was predicated on the notion that one need not act in public affairs with only one's narrowly defined immediate self-interest in mind. When Margaret Thatcher famously said in 1978, and this is 2 years before Reagan, when Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no such thing as society, she said. There was only individual men and women and their families. That was Margaret Thatcher's famous line in England. And that, if there is a talisman to the contemporary right, that's the talisman. So the kind of the three pillars of the contemporary right, privatization, deregulation, and elimination of all taxes and all burdens on wealth, came together in the assault on Social Security. But the funny thing about the way in which Bush phrased it is that the ideology and the rhetoric of the attack on Social Security was anti-statist. And this is one of the contradictions that you find in the contemporary right. Here's Bush talking about the opportunity of society and talking, as the right always has, that the government and bureaucracies and social reform and social welfare stifle individual liberty, get in the way of individual opportunity. It's time to set the individual free so he or she can make his or her own decisions and let the magic of the marketplace decide about winners and losers. So the attack on social reform and the attack on a state-organized policy of economic redistribution took the form of a state-organized, anti-statist set of positions. And this has been true since Ronald Reagan became president and announced that government was the problem and that the way in which the government had to move was to get government out of people's pockets and off of their backs. So there are these kinds of inherent contradictions. The second piece of it has to do with the destruction or the attempt to destroy liberalism internationally and when it comes to foreign affairs. And this is really where the chickens do come home to roost. The whole structure of international law, the whole structure of treaty obligations, and particularly the liberal, and when I say liberal, I mean that this was also basically agreed to by Ford and by Nixon as well, and even by Reagan. The whole structure of the United Nations, the whole sense that the United States lives in a world society, just as individual citizens live in a domestic society, that too has been the target of the right. And so what you have is a celebration of unilateralism. You have this notion of preemption, which, as Michael said, and it's true, is a totally preposterous from the standpoint of international law. It's a totally preposterous position that a state has the right to act in advance of any real threat. But whether it's an attack on international law or the UN or allies or treaty obligations, there's a coming together of these two prongs of this attack on contemporary liberalism, namely an assault upon the idea that power can be constrained by obligation to others, whether domestically or internationally. What you have is a coherent ideology that says that power is what power does. There's this very, very famous interview that Ron Suskind reported on. I don't know if you guys saw this in the Times Magazine section about a year and a half ago. And he was talking with a highly placed administration official about the difference between a faith-based community and a reality-based community. And what this guy said, and it's funny on some levels, but it's not funny on others, is this was the classic statement of the authoritarian. We create our own reality. Power does what power does. And the important thing is to loosen the constraints upon power so that it can do what it needs to do. Now, when that is allied with the notion that you are living in the world's most favored country, and that God intends the United States to reorganize the world, you have yourself the theory of the unitary presidency. And that has been articulated. There's a tendency when you look at George Bush to look at him as an inarticulate fool who can barely speak a coherent sentence. But there really is a coherent body of thought behind all this. The theory of the unitary presidency is a theory of untrammeled executive power. It is contemptuous not only of international treaty obligations, it is openly contemptuous of the Congress, it is openly contemptuous of any legal strictures on its authority, and it is a particularly ruthless and a particularly aggressive formulation of an intensification and concentration of all the trends that have marked the contemporary right. So we're back to the original question. The original question is how did these guys get to be so radical? How did this thing develop? Well, there are three or four possibilities to explain just why this tendency to concentrate power and to have done with the notion that we live in a society with obligations to others. There are a bunch of different possibilities about why this happened. The first is that people who observe radical social movements observe that they often become radicalized to the extent that they're isolated. The more isolated they are, the more radical they tend to become. That's probably not the case here, since these guys have been in power and have had a remarkable series of successes for the better part of 25 years now. Another possibility is that as the time horizon seems to shrink, but as the goals become more ambitious, the tendency is to say, I have so little time to do this very important project, so let's ratchet things up and get more concentrated and get more serious about it. The third, which is also a real possibility, is this is simply a matter of historic opportunity, that 9/11 opened the door to these guys. There's a very, very famous conversation that McGeorge Bundy reports on in his memoirs in discussion about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. When they're sitting around talking about how they're going to respond to what they thought at the time was a real North Vietnamese attack on these two American destroyers. And in retrospect, Bundy says that when they were talking about how to respond, Walt Rostow, who was this political scientist, one of the lessons of all this is whether you look at Walt Rostow or Wolfowitz or any of these guys, is don't let political scientists, or Henry Kissinger, don't let political scientists get anywhere near state power. Keep us here. Keep us away from any influence at all, because the marriage of ideology and the marriage of power is really, really dangerous. Rostow was talking about how trains leave the station on a predetermined schedule, but every so often there's a rogue element that sneaks in, and you gotta know when to jump on. And Rostow reports that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, or the Gulf of Tonkin incident, was just such a historic opportunity. It was time to get on board. It's very likely that these guys saw 9/11 as a historic opportunity to do that which they had always been wanting to do that which they had intended to do, and that which they had been organizing to do. And so we're in this kind of new world of preemptive strikes, both at home and domestically.
That was John Ehrenberg, speaking at the Left Forum this year on a panel entitled Bush and Company's War on Civil Liberties and What It Means for Our Future. The panel was chaired by our own Michael Smith.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.